Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. In some ways, you almost have to admire the mosquitoes that pester us this time of year. The way they procreate.
They actually mate in flight.
They can breed pretty much anywhere.
A bottle cap that fills with rainwater.
They can survive a cold winter.
They produce a lot of sugar in their cells that works like antifreeze, and so it prevents them from freezing.
This is mosquito researcher Laura Harrington. She's an entomologist at Cornell University. Of course, the main thing we notice about mosquitoes is that they bite us. One of the things Laura wanted to understand was why mosquitoes that bite humans choose us, as opposed to other animals. Like, why not feed on horses or dogs?
What sort of reinforces that behavior?
For Laura, that work meant a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, or mostly blood.
I did a series of fitness studies where I looked at whether human blood is actually better for them. And in order to do that, I had to give them a live human host. And so that was myself. So I fed mosquitoes on my arms. And then I also fed them on other types of blood and compared their fitness. What I found was that indeed human blood is superior for mosquitoes. They produce more eggs, they live longer if they feed on human blood. After that, any time that I do a fitness study, when I ask different questions with these human biting mosquitoes, I have to feed them on myself in order to really replicate what's happening.
So how many bites are we talking about?
Well, I can feed up to 1,000 mosquitoes at once.
Ew.
And I don't react at all. I am totally immune. I don't have any sort of reaction to feeding them.
How come? So you don't get that itchy bite that everybody else gets?
I don't. That itchy bite is caused by different components of the saliva that they inject. And our immune system responds to those different components. And I've basically gotten to the point where I just don't respond to those at all.
So you weren't always immune to it?
I wasn't. No, when I first started, it was quite painful.
So if I got myself bitten by 1,000 and some mosquitoes, I might get immune to this too?
It actually has to be probably more than that. That would be just one experiment. So I wouldn't recommend it for you.
There are about 3,500 different species of mosquitoes. Only a few of them actually feed on humans. And it's only the females. They need our blood for making their eggs. They make lots of eggs, hundreds of them over the course of their life cycle. So those mosquitoes can turn a lovely spring evening into an itchy nightmare. They ruin picnics and backyards. But beyond that, they spread some of the worst diseases all over the world.
All mosquito viruses are transmitted in the saliva. So mosquitoes have salivary glands, and the viruses are injected into the host in the saliva when the mosquito feeds.
Mosquitoes can spread dengue fever, West Nile virus, Zika, Eastern equine encephalitis, yellow fever, malaria.
It was right around the 1900s when scientists first started to put the pieces of the puzzle together and realize that mosquitoes were actually directly transmitting pathogens.
And ever since then, we've been in a serious battle to kill lots of them, to reduce their numbers. On today's episode, our contentious relationship with mosquitoes, a formidable enemy and beautiful foe. Keeping mosquito populations under control on a community level means constant monitoring out in nature, any place where they can breed. Alan Yu has this profile of one of the unsung heroes of mosquito control, who actually is rather fond of these creatures.
Entomologist Autumn Angelus kills mosquitoes that try to bite her, like the rest of us. But before she slaps, she'll look to see what kind it is first. and she is always looking for mosquitoes. We're trudging through muddy puddles at Elmer Lake Wildlife Management Area in New Jersey, trying to find mosquito larvae in the dirty, tea-colored water sitting stagnant on the ground.
I think I just saw a mosquito. Oh no. No. Darn.
Wait, were you disappointed that that wasn't actually a mosquito?
Yeah, I'm always disappointed. You know, I'm always looking for mosquito larvae. I'm always looking for mosquitoes. Even when we went to Disney World, I was checking the bromeliads for mosquito larvae.
She studies insects and specializes in mosquitoes. And though she likes them, part of her job is to keep them in check. She works for Salem County Mosquito Control in New Jersey.
I find them very fascinating, so I'm always looking for them.
She almost always has an aspirator, a mosquito-catching device in her purse. She also has a dipper, which is a plastic ladle connected to a long stick. She scoops up ladles of water and peers inside for wriggling young mosquitoes.
Yay! Larvae! So there's a whole bunch of larvae in here, and there's several different instars.
An instar is a growth stage for the larvae. They look like tiny black dots attached to hyperactive tails.
More of the same in here. Yeah, this is a busy little puddle here.
She also collects some of the water with the mosquito larvae in a plastic bag, so she can try and raise them back in her lab. Another part of her job is to go through whatever gets caught in various insect traps in strategic locations to stay on top of what mosquitoes are active.
It can get very tedious and messy because the other insect scales tend to get everywhere. So sometimes you're blowing your nose and you have insect parts that come out.
She's been working in mosquito control for more than a decade, since she was 18. That's when she met the one, the mosquito that got her into mosquitoes.
This is Taxorhynchites rutilus. That is my favorite. And yes, she's a very good mosquito. Its common name is the elephant mosquito. And that's because of this long curved proboscis. So it kind of looks like a elephant trunk.
That shape means they do not drink blood. She worked with the entomologist at the time to feed their larvae and raise them into adults.
The first time I saw an adult and its brilliant colors, its green and yellow and blue colors, I was just amazed. So after that, I kind of went searching for them, and every time I found one, I would keep it and I would rear it out, and I never really grasped the gravity of how wonderful they are until I was really caring for them and trying to colonize them, because they're so specific and they're so picky.
For example, these mosquitoes mate while they fall through the sky. The female lays her eggs one at a time by dive bombing them into holes in trees. Autumn and another entomologist in Texas are trying to raise these mosquitoes because their larvae will actually eat other mosquito larvae, so they could potentially be used to kill mosquitoes that spread diseases like West Nile virus or Eastern equine encephalitis. And that's her job too, to test mosquitoes to see what viruses they have and keep the disease-spreading mosquito populations down.
Most people in mosquito control are very passionate about what we do, and it's just unfortunate that we kind of get ignored. We're like the redheaded stepchild of the government departments. Even just trying to get the word out there that we exist is difficult.
Have you seen the show Parks and Recreation?
Yeah, yep.
Did they have a mosquito person in there?
No, they didn't, and it's very disappointing. No, they didn't. I was really hopeful. It is funny that you bring that up, though, because my husband always says that I'm the Leslie Knope of mosquito control, because I'm, like, always so excited about it.
Mosquitoes, of course, have been living in the marshlands and plains of New Jersey long before any humans came. They've figured out every place where they could live.
They're very successful creatures.
And sometimes, of course, they are too successful. Autumn says 2018 was an especially bad year.
We had a lot of rain the year before, and we had a lot of rain that year. And there was just mosquito habitat everywhere, and the populations were out of control.
There were so many mosquitoes that Autumn and her colleagues had to call in a helicopter to spray a chemical that kills mosquito larvae over a field.
The farm field was underwater, and it was acres upon acres upon acres of floodwater, but it was not deep enough where there was fish to eat the larvae, and it was just enough that there was just floodwater mosquito broods coming off one after another after another. The traps in the area were so inundated with mosquitoes.
Autumn says because of climate change, warm weather starts earlier and lasts longer. So mosquito season has gotten longer and longer.
Actually, New Jersey is going to be doing disease testing earlier this year for the first time, because with climate change, we're finding that we have disease early and earlier. It's going to be a change, and it's going to be busy, but I'm excited to see what comes of it, because I think that we are having disease circulation a lot earlier than anybody realizes, and that's scary. But it is always good to keep in mind that there is that good mosquito out there.
That story was reported by Alan Yu before the coronavirus outbreak really started in America. Autumn and her colleagues are still out there keeping those mosquito numbers in check. We're talking about mosquitoes, what we're doing to keep their numbers down, and why they're such a formidable pest to fight. Mosquitoes can carry all kinds of diseases. That's why we have to keep an eye on them. So how about the coronavirus? I asked Cornell entomologist Laura Harrington about that, and she said it's really, really unlikely.
Yeah, so these associations between the mosquito and the viruses that they transmit are very intricate associations that develop over time. And if you think about it, the virus actually has to live in two very different types of hosts to be successful, a warm-blooded human and a cold-blooded invertebrate or mosquito. The virus has to overcome tremendous challenges to make it to those salivary glands. It has to get out of the stomach of the mosquito, get into the body cavity, and then invade the salivary gland somehow to be injected.
We're talking about mosquitoes, known to ruin a barbecue or pool party, but also responsible for spreading some of the worst diseases that plague humanity. One thing we've learned from dealing with this coronavirus outbreak is that we don't like to think about threats until they are right in our face. The longer we can say, this is not a big deal, the better, right? That's what public health officials in Colorado are facing when it comes to the West Nile virus. In the vast majority of West Nile cases, people show few or no symptoms. But about 20% of confirmed cases do show symptoms, and some have serious neurological reactions. It can be deadly. West Nile has killed more than 2,000 people nationwide since it was first detected in the U.S. more than 20 years ago, and it's left many more severely disabled. Reporter Stina Sieg takes us to a rural town in western Colorado where a passionate few are trying to wake everyone else up to the danger buzzing around them.
All summer, the small town of Paonia has free music nights at its downtown park. It's always packed with families camped out on blankets, surrounded by food trucks and beer stands. And always, there's a table with free mosquito repellent, which often goes unused. I asked people about West Nile on one of those beautiful summer evenings last year. Most knew about the virus, but were not concerned. Drew Henry was visiting from Arizona, from an area where West Nile has been found.
Isn't that like worrying about getting hit by like a meteor or something? Like, should I always be walking around with a hard hat on?
Janet King, a local, told me she knows four people who've contracted West Nile, including her husband. But she refuses to live in fear of it because mosquitoes are ubiquitous.
Which is why I think people don't want to acknowledge what damage it does, because you can't do anything about it if you have it, and you can't really keep a mosquito from biting you.
health officials strongly disagree and stress using approved insect repellent, covering up, and even avoiding the outdoors at dusk and dawn. A few nights after that concert, across town, a mosquito-killing fog pumped out the back of a pickup truck and into the warm evening air. Spraying still has plenty of critics here, but has become less controversial as it's become more targeted. Mike Clausen sprays a small part of the county from spring through the beginning of fall. He says when he passes locals, he sometimes gets a thumbs up.
That's when you know you're appreciated.
But by the end of spraying season in 2019, the county had registered 33 West Nile cases, more than twice that of any other county in the state. Two people died. Ken Nordstrom heads the Delta County Department of Environmental Health and is a staunch advocate of a county-wide approach to eliminating mosquitoes, especially getting rid of standing water where they breed.
We need it. We need it.
Buddy thinks it's got to come from a grassroots effort. It has to feel important to people, he says. It has to feel personal. And he can think of one place to start.
Oh, I think stories.
Stories of West Nile's victims that show this can be a real and serious threat. In the summer of 2018, Betsy Marston realized her husband, Ed, was not well.
He felt tired and confused and listless.
Ed, the former publisher of the High Country News, a well-known magazine in the West, had recently had a successful heart bypass operation. Betsy says he'd been recovering well and was back up to hiking 2 miles a day through the wilderness surrounding Paonia. But all of a sudden, his body went downhill.
And then finally, he could barely walk, and that's when we went to the ER.
By the time the test results came back positive for West Nile, the virus had been eating away at his body and mind for a little more than a week. He shook uncontrollably. He was practically comatose. Soon, he died.
West Nile disease is brutal. You suffer. He suffered.
West Nile can cause inflammation of the brain, seizures, and paralysis. There is no vaccine and no cure.
People are unwilling to accept a hazard that seems so ephemeral, I think. It's just a bug. You know, you slap it and it's dead.
Betsy's now part of a local survivors group. John Vandenberg is one of those survivors. He was also a longtime friend of Ed's. On the day of Ed's funeral, he collapsed in his living room.
And was unconscious on the floor and ended up semi-conscious for a couple weeks, paralyzed.
John also had West Nile. He initially lost 30 IQ points. He needed a wheelchair. He since started that local survivors group and is also a member of a national group, thousands of people strong. He tells his story at public meetings and local organizations. John recently stopped using a walker after more than a year. He knows he's one of the lucky ones, and not just because his body and mind are coming back.
I had friends, I had relatives, I had support, I had financial abilities. If you don't have any of those things, try to imagine not all of a sudden you can't walk and your arms don't work and your brain's going haywire.
John says people pay attention when they hear his story, but he knows it can be tough to truly believe in this danger.
Before I got West Nile, when I'd look at my area, I would see nothing but wonderfulness. Now I look at my area and think it's wonderful, it's beautiful, but boy, I better be careful.
Because even though the odds are minuscule, he now understands how much a life can change from one mosquito bite.
That was Dina Sieg reporting from Colorado. Mosquitoes are really hard to control. It takes constant vigilance. Why is that? I talked about that with Cornell entomologist Laura Harrington. What are some of the qualities that make mosquitoes so good at surviving alongside with us and really breeding anywhere and everywhere and being alive the second the weather warms up? Here they are.
Yeah. Well, that is one feature for temperate mosquitoes that is really fascinating. So they've been able to survive very cold winters. And oftentimes people will notice that they'll have mosquitoes biting in the fall, and then it'll come winter, the mosquitoes disappear. Where are they? Well, they're actually hibernating. And what they do is they produce a lot of sugar in their cells that works like antifreeze. And so it prevents them from freezing. And so some will survive the winter in the egg stage, in tiny little eggs under the snowpack. Some will survive as immature stages. They're actually frozen in blocks of ice. And then some will survive, will overwinter as adults, and they'll come into human houses, into basements and sheds, and spend the winter there in a sheltered environment. They basically just shut down their metabolism through the winter, and then they're ready to go when it warms up again in the spring.
Wow. So they just hang out there? Do they fly around, or they just sort of chill in my basement?
Yeah, they will fly around. And in fact, they come into my basement too. And when we turn the furnace up in the winter, sometimes they'll start flying around. So they're stimulated by the warmth.
How long do they live?
That's a really good question, and it's a hard one to answer. We can put mosquitoes in a lab cage, and we can measure how long they survive, but that's very artificial. The males typically live no more than 2 weeks. Females live 3 to 4 weeks in general. And out in nature, it's a little bit trickier to figure that out. The best way to do it is to mark them, release them, and then recapture them.
How do you mark a mosquito?
Very carefully. it requires a microscope. And I have a couple of ways that I mark them. One is with a very small spot of paint on the back of the mosquito. I actually shave a fine paintbrush down to one bristle and dip it in a non-toxic paint and then apply it to the mosquito. And then that will stay on their body for quite a long time.
But then how do you find them again?
Yeah, that's tricky too. For some of the human feeding mosquitoes that we study, they tend to just stay in people's homes or right around their homes. And so we take what looks like a big vacuum cleaner and we vacuum them off sites where they're resting. And we can usually recapture up to 25% of the mosquitoes we release that way.
Coming up, could you genetically engineer mosquitoes to self-destruct?
And when we release those out into the wild, they go out and they find wild female mosquitoes and they mate with them. And then more than 95% of their offspring will die.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about mosquitoes. Only a few species of mosquitoes bite humans. One of them, Aedes aegypti. They have white markings on their legs, and they can spread some of the worst ailments: Zika virus, dengue fever, yellow fever. 100 years ago, a young American public health worker set sail for Brazil to combat the spread of infectious diseases. He was hired by the Rockefeller Foundation, an organization invested in global health initiatives. And he became obsessed with eradicating Aedes aegypti. Reporter Jake J. Smith brings us the story of Fred Soper and his mosquito crusade.
Fred Soper is living in Rio de Janeiro when the outbreak hits.
June 5th, 1928. Newspapers in North have reported 70 cases in Rio. June 14th, wild rumors are heard that Bahia is full of yellow fever.
No one had seen it coming, says science historian Nancy Lee Stepan.
That was a total surprise. The Brazilians had a very good record, actually, of controlling yellow fever.
And in Soper's opinion, the outbreak could have been prevented. Brazil's health department hadn't been vigilant enough about monitoring yellow fever, he thinks. It was a failure of administration. But if there's one thing Fred Soper can do, it's administrate. He just spent 7 years organizing health campaigns in Brazil and Paraguay, fighting hookworm disease with the Rockefeller Foundation. And he didn't get the nickname the Commander for nothing.
He had a very upright bearing, a mustache. He looked rather like a soldier. He conducted himself rather like not just a soldier, I would say, but a general.
Shortly after the outbreak, Brazil's Yellow Fever Service is reorganized under Soper's command. And to him, the path forward is clear. With hard work and organization, he thinks that he can eradicate yellow fever for good. He just needs to figure out how. It's common knowledge that the disease is carried by the Aedes aegypti mosquito. And there are brigades of inspectors who go around patrolling for these bugs. So, for 3 months, Soper follows these inspectors all around the northeast of Brazil, going from house to house, destroying the mosquito's breeding places, keeping meticulous records. And this, Soper comes to think, is how you eradicate a disease. Soon, he sends brigades to do the same thing all across Brazil.
He had this idea of the perfection of public health administration, that you could achieve your goals if you were completely perfect in everything that you did. And since the world is not perfect, things did go wrong.
Things promptly go wrong. For a long time, everyone had thought that yellow fever could only exist in mosquitoes or in humans. But a few years after the outbreak, they discovered that monkeys living in rainforests can also harbor yellow fever. Which means the only way to truly eradicate the disease would be to exterminate all the monkeys, which no one is eager to do. This puts a kink in Soper's plan. Up until now, eradicating the disease, yellow fever, has been his main goal. With that no longer possible, he starts to change his focus. It was an idea that had been stirring in his mind for years.
April 13th, 1927. Some thoughts that came to me this morning.
Maybe he can't eradicate yellow fever, but...
Is it possible to exterminate Aedes aegypti in limited control areas?
What if instead he eradicated the mosquito that causes it?
He was very, very convinced that he had the answer.
Now let's be clear. There's a world of difference between controlling a disease and eradicating a species from a country of 3 million square miles, like Brazil. Disease experts mock him for this. Even the Rockefeller Foundation, who he works for, thinks that eradicating a mosquito isn't what they came here to do. None of which matters to Fred Soper.
The aegypti mosquito was now the enemy rather than yellow fever.
And this plan soon receives government sanction. In October 1930, shortly after Soper takes over the National Yellow Fever Program, there's a revolution in Brazil. Getúlio Vargas overthrows the elected government in a coup.
He was an authoritarian, often called the Mussolini of Brazil.
Soper quickly calls a meeting with this new leader, and they hit it off. Vargas gives Soper permission to do whatever he needs to do. And this is when Soper's dream of eradication starts to look feasible. Now, all over the country, his mosquito brigades are allowed to fumigate people's houses with insecticide. If they find mosquitoes breeding in a house, they get to impose fines on the owners. When someone in a suspect area dies of unknown causes, Soper sends a worker to the funeral where they cut out a chunk of the deceased person's liver to be biopsied, with or without the family's permission. At one point, a newspaper calls this new set of laws draconian, and one of Soper's colleagues suggests that the government should censor such criticism.
But I pointed out that it was draconian, and the fact should be well known before the service started to enforce it.
And all of this seems to work.
By 1940, six states and the city of Rio de Janeiro were on the eradicated list.
Now, at this point, they've actually developed a vaccine for yellow fever. But Soper still insists that mosquito eradication is the way to get rid of the disease in the long term. And in his defense, that seemingly impossible goal is looking more and more likely every year.
The first serious proposal that I leave Brazil had come shortly after the attack on Pearl Harbor.
World War II begins, and the U.S. Army calls on Soper for his expertise. He spends the next 4 years fighting malaria in Egypt, preventing typhus in Italy, experimenting with the use of DDT. He saves millions of lives. But through all of this, eradicating Aedes aegypti remains in the back of his mind, this goal that's just within reach. After the war, Soper is appointed the director of the Pan-American Sanitary Bureau, and he sees his chance to make eradication happen not just in Brazil, but across the American continent.
And he sets this in motion and literally crisscrosses the Americas, trying to make governments commit themselves to achieving this end.
He succeeds. Country after country sets up programs like the one he'd been running in Brazil, After 10 years, in 1958, for the first time ever, the WHO certifies entire countries free of Aedes aegypti. There's Brazil and Bolivia and Belize.
The Canal Zone, Ecuador, French Guiana.
Nicaragua, Panama.
Paraguay, Peru, Uruguay.
After this, even more countries sign on. And Soper becomes the godfather of eradication. This crazy idea of his is actually catching on. He lectures to medical students and health workers, saying things like,
"Administration is the essence of eradication."
And,
"He who rides the tiger may not dismount, so long as the tiger lives."
Because even as the concept of eradication is spreading across the continent, Soper is terrified that it's all going to come crashing down, as he should be.
When you get to a very low rate, when the mosquito becomes almost invisible, is precisely when public health agencies tend to give up. And as a consequence, almost inevitably, the mosquito comes back.
August 22nd, 1967. Dear Paolo, the most immediate reason for this note is the news of the reinfestation of Belém do Pará with Aedes aegypti. It is especially important that Brazil move immediately.
By 1967, Soper is very shocked to discover that a large area of northeastern Amazon is infected by the insect. And by that time, Brazil had lost its certification as free of Aedes aegypti. So it had got it, and then it had lost it.
What happened? Once these countries were certified aegypti-free, it was hard to convince their leaders to keep dedicating time and money to these programs. Plus, it's hard to say today whether they were ever truly eradicated in the first place. In other words, Soper's detractors had been proven right. And the public health community, which had recently made a hero out of Soper, starts to turn against him. The next year, the director of the CDC publishes a lecture questioning whether the eradication of Aedes aegypti, Soper's holy grail, is still worth pursuing. He points out that it hasn't worked, that they have vaccines against yellow fever, and can they really keep asking these small, poor countries in Central America to pour money into eradication if there are better, cheaper options? Soper responds in turn.
I cannot remain silent in the face of these surprising proposals.
And he doubles down on his failed strategy. Stay the course, he says. We've been free of yellow fever for so long.
The long-term continuation of this freedom must be based on the recognition of Aedes aegypti as the enemy to be feared.
It's a refrain he'll continue repeating for another 9 years, to increasingly deaf ears, as country after country disbands its eradication program. In 1977, Fred Soper dies in Wichita, Kansas, not far from his birthplace. No longer a laughingstock, no longer a hero, but somewhere in between.
That was Jake J. Smith reporting. Will you be called a hero of mosquito control or a villain? Some of the people doing this work today still face that same question. In one Florida community, officials want to try a new approach involving genetic modifications that they say could be a game changer. But many community members have not been happy. Liz Tung brings us this story.
Our story begins in the Florida Keys, a string of islands that curve down from the tip of Florida southwest towards Cuba. These days, the Keys are mostly known as a tourist destination. Its 1,700 islands run through the Everglades, covering miles of coral reefs and mangrove swamps that pulse with some of the world's most unique wildlife. And then, of course, there's famous party destination Key West. It's the kind of place where you can go snorkeling, tour some wetlands, and go bar hopping, all in the same day. But there was a time less than 100 years ago when the Florida Keys weren't ruled by humans, but rather by mosquitoes.
There's a well-known saying here in Florida, if it weren't for air conditioning and mosquito control, Florida would still be basically uninhabitable.
That's Phil Goodman. He's one of the Keys' top leaders in the war against mosquitoes, specifically Aedes aegypti.
You know, there's a lot of stories of back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. If you were driving in the Florida Keys at night and you had a flat tire, you just stayed in your car, because it was impossible to change your tire outside without the mosquitoes eating you alive.
A big part of what turned things around in the Keys is the FKMCD, otherwise known as the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District.
We are the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District, and our job is to protect residents and visitors from the threat that mosquitoes pose to their quality of life
and to their health.
I know this ad makes them sound weirdly like the A-Team, but the FKMCD is actually a tax-funded agency that was created in 1940. It's one of the most cutting-edge groups of its kind just about anywhere, with an army of researchers, helicopter pilots to spray insecticide, and field inspectors who traverse some pretty punishing terrain.
Our offshore inspectors travel by boat to uninhabited islands and trudge through the swamps to inspect, treat, and set traps.
The operation is managed by five elected commissioners, including Phil Goodman. He first got interested in mosquito control about 10 years ago, after retiring from his job in the chemical industry. Phil figured the FKMCD would be a chance to flex his science background for the good of the community.
You know, the Florida Keys, we are really the potential hotspot for these mosquito-borne viruses.
In fact, just 2 years before Phil was elected, the Keys had an outbreak of dengue fever for the first time in 60 years. So the FKMCD launched an aggressive campaign against the mosquitoes that spread dengue, Aedes aegypti. But in the process, they made a disturbing realization. The insecticides they relied on weren't working so well anymore.
It's resistant to some of the chemicals that we use, and it's becoming more and more resistant. So in order to control this virus, you know, we can't spray our way out of this. We've got to look for new technologies.
That's how Phil heard about a young British biotech company called Oxitec.
The real vision of Oxitec is a world that is free from the insects that transmit diseases and that destroy crops.
That's Nathan Rose, Oxitec's head of regulatory affairs. The company had also set their sights on Aedes aegypti, but they were using new methods.
What the scientists wanted to do was to use advances in genetics and biotechnology to find a way to target these mosquitoes in a way that was really safe and effective that didn't require the use of chemical insecticides.
Oxitec did that by developing mosquitoes with what's called a self-limiting gene, basically a self-destruct button. Unless the mosquitoes receive an antidote when they're still a larva, an antibiotic called tetracycline, they're programmed to die. So Oxitec started breeding male mosquitoes in their lab with a self-limiting gene.
And when we release those out into the wild, they go out and they do what male mosquitoes do really well, which is find wild female mosquitoes, and they mate with them. And then more than 95% of their offspring will die because in the wild they don't have access to this antidote.
Oxitec calls them, somewhat ironically, friendly mosquitoes. Oxitec launched their first trials in 2010 and 2011, first in the Cayman Islands, then in Brazil. And what they saw, they said, was major success.
These trials led to significant decreases in the wild population by as much as 95% reduction. And it also taught us a lot about how to produce and release these mosquitoes effectively.
The data they gathered from those first few trials helped lead to their second generation of friendly mosquitoes, which operate based on the same premise, except that instead of killing all mosquitoes, the self-limiting gene only kills the females. Males were still carriers, but their own self-destruct button was gone.
Male mosquitoes cannot bite. Only females can bite. And so by targeting females, we're actually targeting the mosquitoes that are able to bite and therefore transmit disease.
And also by keeping the males alive, they're giving them a chance to continue mating and continue passing on their self-limiting gene. So Phil Goodman, our guy fighting mosquitoes in the Florida Keys, is hearing about all this, and he is excited. Mosquitoes there are getting resistant to sprays, and this could be the game changer they needed. His colleagues agreed. There was just one problem. Oxitec's genetically modified mosquitoes were so cutting edge, so brand new, that they didn't have regulatory approval to deploy them. I mean, just think, they were talking about releasing literally hundreds of thousands of genetically engineered mosquitoes into the world. They had been tested, but not much, and certainly not in Florida. So Phil and his colleagues started the slow process of pushing a proposal through the local and federal red tape. And then there was one other important step, getting approval from local constituents.
Welcome to the Harvey Government Center. My name is Michael Doyle, and I'm the executive director of the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District.
Oxitec and the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District held their first meeting with locals in 2012. Barry Ray was one of the people who attended.
We had really open minds going into the whole first meeting. I mean, we were actually excited. You know, this sounds cool.
All they knew at that point was the premise. Genetically altered mosquitoes capable of cutting down the local Aedes aegypti population. But Barry says the more questions they asked, the more confused they became.
The questions kept coming, and the answers out of Oxitec were never really spot on, you know?
Why are we being the guinea pigs in Key West when, as your documents showed, your cases of fever?
You know, people started scratching their head. And when people left that meeting, they were more concerned than when they walked in.
Community pushback grew. Environmental groups got involved. A petition was launched. Barry says it all could have been resolved if Oxitec just answered their questions. But as the debate grew, the two sides moved further apart, and the rhetoric amped up.
We are humans, and we don't like being treated like guinea pigs.
These mutant bugs.
Hey, this is a Frankenskeeter, like something from Jurassic Park.
Phil, on the other hand, says community members were drowning in misinformation.
Then there were some environmental activist groups that really were against any kind of genetic modification. They put out a lot of false information to the community. This slowed us down.
There was something else slowing them down, too. They needed approval from federal regulators to move ahead with the trial. That process dragged on for years. In the meantime, the debate inside the Florida Keys settled to a dull roar. Then, in September 2019, a new study dropped a minor bombshell on the whole argument. It was entitled Transgenic Aedes aegypti Mosquitoes Transferred Genes into a Natural Population. And it was spearheaded by a well-respected Yale professor named Jeffrey Powell. He said he'd been hearing about Oxitec for years on the conference circuit.
And I would ask them after their talk, I said, did you ever consider whether releasing all these male transgenic males would affect the genetics of the natural populations? And usually they would say, no, we haven't thought about that. And that would be it.
So Jeffrey set out to get an answer for himself. He just so happened to be in Brazil while Oxitec was conducting their first ever trial there. So he decided to do his own analysis of how or if Oxitec's mosquitoes were affecting the genetics of the local mosquito population. Over a span of about 2 years, he took samples and found that Oxitec's mosquitoes were mixing some of their genes with the native mosquitoes.
They're passing on genes because not 100% of their offspring are dying. Enough make it through and are mating and getting incorporated into the population. We don't know what the consequences is from a practical standpoint.
In other words, he didn't find any evidence that it particularly mattered, but that didn't stop Jeffrey from speculating.
It's possible they're bringing genes that could affect insecticide resistance that didn't exist there before. It could be bringing genes that enhance their ability to transmit some viruses. We just don't know, to tell you the truth.
The study got a lot of media coverage, with headlines like, "Scientists accidentally create new mutant super mosquito in the wild," which only fueled further pushback against Oxitec's potential trial in the Keys. But lots of people were questioning Jeffrey's findings.
I was kind of surprised at the claims that were made.
That's Brian Lovett. He's an insect pathologist and mosquito expert who called in to serve as an objective judge of Jeffrey's paper.
I thought that they were pretty irresponsible. I was surprised that it had made it through peer review without those claims being questioned. And my view was on the whole shared by the community.
The study earned criticism from Oxitec and even several of the study's co-authors. Jeffrey says a lot of this pushback is just political and says he doesn't have any kind of anti-GMO agenda.
I'm not against genetically modified organisms. Tell you the truth, I think genetically modifying mosquitoes in a way that they're less able to transmit diseases is a good idea. But I think sometimes we have to be careful. And, you know, we can't just be releasing these things without really understanding what's going to happen.
The study gave new life to the fight over the Oxitec trial. But that debate came to an end, or at least closer to an end, earlier this month, when, after years of waiting, federal regulators finally gave the okay for Oxitec to move ahead. It's not a sure thing yet. They still have a few more regulatory hurdles to clear, and community members say they're planning to keep on fighting. But for Oxitec and Phil Goodman, this was a big victory.
But like I say, not everybody's happy. So, yeah. But our job is not to make everybody happy. You know, our job is to control mosquitoes in the Florida Keys. And that's what we do. You know, in the end, it's our decision to do what's right. We're the ones held accountable.
That story was reported by Liz Tung in April of this year. Since then, local authorities approved the release of over 750 million genetically modified mosquitoes into the Florida Keys over the course of the next 2 years. Oxitec has also won federal approval to release its mosquitoes in Texas. Mosquitoes spread disease and also just lots of everyday misery. And even on a personal level, like in our own backyards, we spend a ton of money and effort trying to fight them. And it seems like everybody has an idea about what mosquitoes like or don't like. So what really works? Here's Cornell University entomologist Laura Harrington. Now, I always say that mosquitoes just terrorize me. And I get bitten so many times, a lot more than many other people. Is there any truth to that, that some people just attract mosquitoes where others don't?
There is some truth to that. And that's a big question that nobody's really been able to figure out completely. It's complicated. And part of the complication is that as humans, we emit hundreds of compounds that individually have been shown to be attractive to mosquitoes. So it's really people with the ideal blend of these hundreds of compounds that are probably more attractive than others. And so there are people who've spent decades working on this to try to understand the optimal blend of those odors.
I'm wondering, you know, we always hear all these different tips and tricks that people say supposedly repel mosquitoes. Like some people swear by skin so soft. Other people say, oh, you have to have a dryer sheet on you. And on and on and on. Citronella candles. Does any of this stuff really work?
There's no good evidence that any of those really work. The one exception would be any sort of oily material that you apply to your skin is going to inhibit the mosquito from landing and biting. And so skin so soft might work well for that, you know, in some cases for that reason. But there's no real good, rigorous, peer-reviewed studies that have shown that citronella or any of those materials really work.
What about, I've heard some people say if you put a really strong fan, like let's say you're sitting outside on your porch and you put a really strong fan there, that it makes it harder for the mosquitoes to fly toward you because you're blasting this fan in their direction.
Yes, that's something that I recommend for people, and that works very well because they are weak flyers. And so if you're having an outdoor picnic, you can set some fans up under the table to keep the mosquitoes from biting your ankles. That can work well.
Laura Harrington is a professor in the Department of Entomology at Cornell University and the director of the Northeast Regional Center for Excellence in Vector-Borne Diseases. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.